Hi, this is Millie Long, co-editor-in-chief of the American Journal of Gastroenterology. And for this podcast, I have the pleasure of having my co-editor-in-chief on, Dr. Jaz Bajaj. But he's talking to us this time on the newest released guidelines on hepatic encephalopathy. So, Jaz, welcome to the podcast on the other side of the desk, so to speak.
It's a new feeling.
Yeah, exactly. Now I get to ask the questions and you have to respond. So it's great. But obviously, we're all really excited about this guideline. The new hepatic encephalopathy guideline came out, and I believe it has been some time since this has been updated. Would you mind just start off by telling us why did this need updating? Kind of, I know in the document you discussed a lot about the changes in the burden of HE. Tell us a little bit about the background.
So hepatic encephalopathy, for those who are not aware, is one of the most impactful complications of cirrhosis that is felt not only by the patients, but the families and the healthcare system. And it really is often ignored or not completely taken care of because there's a lot of problems with the definitions and diagnosis. And therefore, people are either over or undertreated. And as a result, a lot of people are treated not adequately. The other thing we want to figure out is the hepatic encephalopathy is increasing as the first decompensation. And among patients with MASH cirrhosis, it is clearly the first decompensating event, which is really a big problem. It really affects a lot of people across the U.S., although the things are not completely reliable. Overt hepatic encephalopathy affects around 40% of patients with cirrhosis, and that is pretty high. When you talk about this, there is a long prelude of this, which is called covert or minimal hepatic encephalopathy. When you look at it from a cost perspective, it is also a very costly disease. And from a hospital management perspective, it's also a very expensive disease inside in the world because it causes a lot of preventable readmissions in patients with cirrhosis. And the uncaptured costs are often the effect it has on the patients, their family members, and their quality of life. So clinically, psychosocially, and financially, it is a big, big burden. And we were very delighted that the college entrusted us, me and my colleagues, to actually come up with this guideline because it is past due at this stage.
Absolutely. And, I see that. Obviously, my practice isn't as much cirrhosis, but you see the impact on families when you see these patients and what it means and, the extended hospitalizations. And it's so important to get this right. And one of the things, I gleaned a few things interestingly from the guidelines. The first was you all made a concerted effort to really define things appropriately, because I think you're right that definitions have been loose. One of those was covert or minimal hepatic encephalopathy. Can you talk to our listeners about how can you define that entity as compared to the traditional hepatic encephalopathy that many of us are used to, with clearly an obtunded patient, a patient with asterixis? Talk to us about this covert or minimal HE.
So covert or minimal HE is actually, if you actually analyze people or you actually test people, it is actually present in up to 50% of patients with cirrhosis. And that is a huge chunk of people. And often because we have 15 to 20 minutes to dispend with our patients, we often say, oh my God, he's just feeling bad or she's just feeling bad because it's just the chronic disease. But when you ask patients what is the number one cause of their quality of life problems, and you then cognitively test them, even with a test that takes 1 minute or so, and you treat them, they actually could feel better if they have covert or minimal HE. So important things to know, it is present in majority of the patients with cirrhosis. It is severely under and overdiagnosed. And we're going to talk about that a little bit, because you can't just slap lactulose on people and assume that it is covert HE and not follow them. What we want to do is adequately put some resources in either diagnosing patients correctly or giving them lactulose only for 8 weeks and following them and see if they got better, because many things can cause cognitive complaints. And when patients do respond to medications for hepatic encephalopathy in the covert stage, they actually feel a lot better. They're able to do their jobs much quicker. They become more productive members of society and less dependent on their caregivers. So this is critically an important point. And this often, the medical reason for diagnosing it, I just talked about the psychosocial reason, is patients feeling better. It's a crystal ball into telling us who actually will develop the overt stage, like you described, when the patient is confused, obtunded, and comatose. So this can actually tell you which is the patient who's much more likely to develop that complication rather than the other patients, So it behooves us a little bit to at least, if not be aware of this condition, also to actually try and see if we can actually test for these using certain tests that take 1 to 2 minutes.
So I think that's one thing that this guideline importantly emphasized as well, is what you should be using in diagnosis, such as some of the short survey instruments you described. But another that I saw fairly often amongst recommendations was the role of ammonia. Now, should anyone be ordering ammonia? What is the role for ammonia? Does it help in minimal HE? Does it help in more advanced HE? What is the role of ammonia?
So it is a very controversial question. There is no doubt that ammonia is central to the pathogenesis of hepatic encephalopathy in cirrhosis. However, the translation into practice is where a lot of this falls apart, because there's a huge overlap between people who are completely normal but have poor liver function and people who are obtunded and have high ammonia levels. There's a huge gradation, which is perfect statistically. There's a nice correlation. But when you talk about an individual person, the ammonia levels often overlap so much that they become almost clinically irrelevant for one particular person. So what we have actually done, and we have extended prior guidelines from the other liver societies in saying that the ammonia levels should not be the only tools that you use to diagnose or exclude hepatic encephalopathy in someone. Therefore, you have to use your clinical judgment, even in a confused patient and in a patient like covert hepatic encephalopathy, where you have no idea what is going on with the patient. We have to remember ammonia is a liver function test. So someone with a completely normal mental function who has no cognitive complaints with cirrhosis could still have a high ammonia level. And the last thing we should be doing is to treat their ammonia level rather than the patient. The other thing we want to talk about ammonia levels is they, like anything, like blood sugar, whatever, it actually varies with how the patient is actually feeling at that point. If the patient is dehydrated, the ammonia levels will go up. That's why you remember the first thing we do for a patient that comes in with overt hepatic encephalopathy is to hydrate them. The ammonia levels typically go down just because of that. Ammonia levels go up after eating. And as you know, we have to, once you draw the blood ammonia levels, they have to go and be analyzed within lab within 30 minutes and you have to be put on ice. Because if that is not done, the ammonia levels will again falsely rise. And when studies show, have done, including one in the Red Journal, where the ammonia levels were sent to 8 different labs, the upper limits of normals changed dramatically compared to healthy controls. So given all these problems with translation, it is not useful in our mind to use ammonia either in the inpatient or the outpatient setting as the sole decider of actually diagnosis, exclusion, or monitoring and prognostication of patients with hepatic encephalopathy.
That's helpful. So obviously, as part of a picture, it could be informative, but it should not be the linchpin. And we all see this, you know, these patients land in the emergency room and the emergency room checks an ammonia. And so, and then decisions are made based on that. But that one-time value is not what we should be making those decisions on. It seems very clear. When you look at the guidelines, you divide it between kind of inpatient and certainly some outpatient management. Talk to us a little bit about some of the guideline recommendations on the inpatient side that you think change practice.
Thanks for this. And if you look at the guidelines, the group that helped us with this guideline, we had a stellar group of co-authors and great methodologists who helped us create a lot of flowcharts which are designed to be very clinician-friendly. And what we want to do is we divided the patients, like you said, into covert minimal HE through stages of how a patient would progress. Then the inpatient stage of confusion or hepatic encephalopathy as we know it clinically, and then the post-discharge prevention of recurrence phase, which is a stress test for the entire system and the patient itself. What we want to do is in inpatient setting is do 4 things at the same time. Make sure the patient does not develop aspiration pneumonia. Therefore, if they are grade 3, which means obtunded and stuporose or comatose, they need to go to a monitored setting for airway protection, because that is like the kiss of death at that point. And remembering the aspiration pneumonia can happen because of just the patient's secretions, or if the patient has an upper GI bleed clearly, which can precipitate hepatic encephalopathy, or us giving lactulose in a confused patient by mouth when it should actually be given by enema. That's number one, to make sure the patient is supportive and then the patient gets hydration, like when we talked about with the ammonia. Mm-hmm. Second thing is we have to figure out whether the patient has, what is the precipitant for hepatic encephalopathy. Almost every single case of hepatic encephalopathy is a symptom of something else going on, most likely infection, acute kidney injury, or infection, or, GI.
Yeah.
We need to figure that out. The third thing is to actually make sure there are no alternatives for this. sometimes you do get confused with the patients who actually present as hepatic encephalopathy, or at least you assume hepatic encephalopathy. It turns out to have a stroke. Remember, most of our patients nowadays are being diagnosed in their 60s, as opposed to even 20 years ago when they were in their 40s with hepatitis C. Now we have MASH cirrhosis. This is basically taking over. So those patients do have severe cardiometabolic conditions that can lend themselves to other issues with the brain. And last but not the least is actually start empirical treatment. Like I said, lactulose by enema in advanced. And if that does not work, then rifaximin, as well as taking care of zinc, etc. as well. In between, we should not forget about nutrition in those patients. And nutrition is a really critical, important thing. We should not restrict protein either as an inpatient or as an outpatient setting in these patients. So hepatic encephalopathy in an inpatient setting is an emergency, of course, but it has the potential to do a lot worse if you do not actually pay attention, if you have fragmentation of care. So therefore, if a patient with hepatic encephalopathy comes in, make sure that if you do not have your own inpatient service, to liaise with the hospital medicine providers and actually ensure that they figure out what's going on. And we divided them into five axes. In that axis has why this patient is developing hepatic encephalopathy. Is it cirrhosis? 99% of our patients with VC have cirrhosis. Then what is the grade? Like I said, 2, 3, and 4. 3 is when the patient is stuporose, and 4 is when the patient is comatose, and 2 is when the patient is just confused. And the most important thing is whether it's recurrent hepatic encephalopathy or first episode, because recurrent means there is obviously, this is the group of patients who is likely to then come back again, until and unless you figure out why they had this in the first place. Because the fragmentation of care and or the patients being admitted maybe somewhere else, it is often difficult, unless we make an effort, to find out what was the precipitant the last time around. And if you figure out it's the same precipitant this time, then until and unless you fix that precipitant, that patient is now condemned to come back again. So therefore, putting these 4-5 axes into play in a confused patient makes it very easy for us to figure out where the patient is coming from and where the patient might actually be going in the acute episode.
Well, and then once you're out of the acute, you know, one thing that I thought was very interesting is that there are data that show that kind of assessing the response to lactulose via measuring kind of what output the patient is having, even through something like the Bristol stool scale, which we're all used to using in irritable bowel syndrome and kind of assessing in our GI patients. But talk to us a little bit about how we should be using this in the outpatient setting to ensure that someone is getting appropriate treatment to help to prevent recurrence.
So clearly, prevention of recurrence is the number one issue for these patients, given that preventable readmissions are the bane of existence for patients with hepatic encephalopathy. What we want to do is a multi-pronged approach, but there are medications and non-medications. And in medications, clearly the frontline treatment is still lactulose. We know lactulose is a very cheap medication, but it is also a very expensive medication in terms of human resources. Because if you do not spend enough time with the patient and the family members and figuring out how to take the lactulose, how to actually titrate the bowel movements, how to make sure that the embarrassing GI features that the lactulose symptoms that lactulose often entails does not make the patient stop the lactulose and come back to the hospital because of confusion, this is not going to work out. So when you're starting someone with lactulose on discharge, you have to set aside some time. Otherwise, that patient is going to come back. And one of those things in which the patients and their family members get a little bit of autonomy is to decide what their stool looks like. And instead of saying, I have 2 to 3 bowel movements a day, for someone who has Bristol stool 7, in which they would get dehydrated, those are the patients that one bowel movement a day is also fine. So the patients and family members get to decide. And that actually gives them a little bit of control back as well, which is often so difficult. It's so hard because now people have to relinquish control that they've had their entire life because now they have HE. And if a patient does not do very well on lactulose, we should have a low threshold of starting rifaximin, which has grade A evidence. And rifaximin is often very expensive. So what we want to do is to ensure if the fifth axis that I didn't talk about is social infrastructure. And that is as important as the medical knowledge, because until and unless you can translate this medical knowledge into a drug that the patient has in their hand, it is not going to work out. So instead of just writing a prescription for rifaximin, We have to figure out whether this patient can actually get the rifaximin, and the rifaximin should be in the patient's hand. And if there are any things to actually help the patient get that medication, you really need to get that as soon as possible. In addition, there are other ways to also prevent recurrence that are non-medications. If one of them is actually simply keeping in contact, it is amazing how many people come back because they've either not made an appointment, not given an appointment, or they came to you one time and they didn't go back to their primary MD in time. And between that time, which was around 40 or 50 days after the discharge, when they were the most vulnerable, is when they had to talk to someone no one from the medical community was there. So simply actually creating maybe a call-in within 1 week or 2 weeks after discharge would actually go a long way in preventing this. There are also apps like the Patient Buddy app that can be downloaded for free. There are also other apps that actually can make the system more responsive to the patient, that is non-medical way. And the third, as I just told you, is the nutrition. Nutrition being very important, we want to make sure the patients do not get protein deficient. We want to make sure that the patient eat a late night snack, which is high in protein, and ensure that the patient, if they have ascites, that gets drained and the rest of the things take care of as well. And last but not the least, since this is hepatic encephalopathy, we have to figure out whether this patient is a candidate for liver transplant or not. Mm-hmm. And if you are not in a place which is in a position to offer liver transplant, the first episode of overt hepatic encephalopathy should really trigger you to refer that patient for at least the consideration for a liver transplant evaluation, which, as you know, can take sometimes up to several months to happen. So that's the time to start this process from actually happening. So this is a short and longer term ways to prevent recurrence in patients who have been discharged with hepatic encephalopathy.
You know, that's so great. So we've talked about kind of the whole course, everything from the background, you know, the diagnosis, how to diagnose even minimal or covert, talking about pearls for inpatient management, talking about prevention of recurrence. And I think you mentioned, and I would like to direct our listeners to this guideline document, that there are some great flow documents that I think will be really helpful, these diagrams in clinical practice to help you to implement these guidelines. But just in the last minute or so, Jazz, is there something that you would like to highlight that, you know, if our listeners are like, I take care of patients with cirrhosis, what could they do differently tomorrow based on this guideline that you think would really impact the care of their patients?
So it's like Sophie's choice. I can't pick.
Sophie's choice. Choose something. Yeah.
So the important thing here is to actually realize that covert hepatic encephalopathy exists. If someone comes to you, or you elicit that the patient is cognitively not okay, it behooves us to actually figure out what is going on with the patient. Could be sleep apnea, could be alcohol, could even be a mild cognitive impairment due to dementia, or could be MHE. If you cannot do the testing, at least do some of the questionnaires that we have actually listed, which take less than 1 minute to do. And if any of those are positive, the MOCA, the stop bang questionnaire, or the audit C, then those are the patients that need someone else's input, not ours. If the patient is negative on all of that and they're still cognitively impaired, those are the patients that you want to do a theragnostic trial of lactulose, but do not leave them hanging. Do not start lactulose and not come back to them in 8 weeks. And the lactulose, every time you start lactulose, as we discussed before, the second pearl is to see if it goes with the chaser of the Bristol stool scale. The Bristol stool scale, which keeps the quality and the quantity of the bowel movements in the background and as well as in the patient's autonomous hand, that's really an important thing. And the third thing, as we've beaten to death, which is important, is no unnecessary ammonia levels and no interpretation of ammonia levels in a vacuum. You have to, like anything else in medicine, put the patient and their symptoms in the center of all of this. Ammonia may help you make a diagnosis when everything else also falls into place, but it is very rarely the only driver of the management for these patients.
Well, Jazz, kudos to you and to your whole author team on this great document. Just for our listeners to make sure you're aware, not only is this guideline available in the pages of the American Journal of Gastroenterology, but any ACG member can access our guidelines free on our website. And actually, the ACG makes these guidelines free for viewing so that we can hopefully increase the use of them really across the entire GI community. So please check out the hepatic encephalopathy guideline, and congrats, Jazz, on helping bring this to fruition.
Thank you on behalf of all my authors and the team.